Well, hello. My name is Chris Vogel, and I'm a binge TV watcher. Binge TV watcher, what's that? Well, let me tell you, I'll latch on to a show and stream it kind of exclusively. It all started with a simple thing. I really think the Brinkmans are to blame for this. It was a number of years ago when 24 was a hit, you know, and it came out on DVD. Well, Jen and I, we got the DVD and watched it. It wasn't 24 hours straight, mind you. But over a week or two, we covered a season with little sleep in between. And then we started a second season. Somewhere in there, before the third season, we realized there's got to be an intervention here. And we quickly broke the habit. But then there were others, Arrested Development marathons, Mad Men. Right now, you know, we were doing Downton Abbey for a while, but now that we're in the third season, we're having to wait a whole week in between them, and it just doesn't seem fair or right. I've binged on HGTV, you know, Property Brothers and Bath Crashers, House Hunters International. I love it when some house snob walks into a house, looks at the kitchen, and with a sense of disgust and disdain and revulsion says, "Oh, there's no granite and no stainless. Who could ever live with this?" I sit in my lazy boy in my 40-year-old house, quite content and happy with what's around me. Yeah, we've done some renos here or there, but really? No, through it all, I know that our house will never be anything perhaps featured on HGTV. At least I hope not, because sometimes it's the before shots they might want to look at. But I'm happy with the house I have. It has a solid foundation. We love the kitchen. There's a bathroom, a place for the family to gather. And all in all, it's a good thing. Well, let's face it, we take at times our houses for granted, don't we? It's more than four walls and a roof. Do we really long for something more than just a building, a place where we are safe, a dwelling where our basic needs are not only met, but by word and action, we are encouraged and affirmed, and we are safe there with our husbands, our wives, children. Now, through all of that, this is something that we long in our life for, but we all struggle with to one degree or another. There is not a house, a home here in this congregation where we haven't struggled in one way or another with those that we're having to live with. But we still have that longing. And I think it's really for that reason that God uses this idea of a house, of a home, to communicate with us that which we long for, that we're created for, but that we can never attain here and now. No matter how many renos we do, no matter whether we have granite and stainless and all of the world is perfect, no. The picture that God gives us in the temple that we see in the Old Testament is a wonderful illustration of what God does for us that far exceeds what any house can do, where he brings us into his family. Now, it all started in the Old Testament as the people of Israel were called out of Egypt, out of slaves, and being brought in, adopted as sons and daughters of God. And at first there was the tabernacle, that tent, the building on a move. But as Israel had now, the conquest had ended, the Exodus was finally over. After centuries upon centuries, with Solomon, all their borders were secure. And so it was time to move from that temporary dwelling of a tent to a permanent dwelling, the temple. Now, in weeks past, 2 weeks ago, we started looking at the temple, and what was being described there is just fantastic. The beauty of this building really captures our attention. And as we saw in 1 Kings 6, the beauty of that building was one of rich beauty, but not just a rich beauty, an extravagant, no doubt, at times, but also a beauty that could be a bit restrictive. Just like the homes of the rich and famous, we can't just waltz in there and think that we can live like that. Not at all. There's a certain restriction that's there, but it doesn't end with that. Just as God's holiness and our uncleanness means something has to take place, well, there's a redemptive beauty as well. Just as on the doors of the temple were the cherubim, picturing what we see in Genesis 3 with the cherubim with a flaming sword, keeping Adam and Eve out from going back to the Garden of Eden, that the temple becomes a picture of a home we all long for, of an Eden that we desire, but on our own can never attain. But that God prepares a way for those doors to open wide and for us to walk in. Well, just as our homes are more than just four walls, there's furnishings involved. And so in this temple, there are furnishings as well. And in our passage this morning in 1 Kings chapter 7, those furnishings are being described. Now, as we look at these furnishings, and as I read through this passage, it's going to be kind of an interesting section to take a look at, because it's, I think, a little uncommon for us. We don't think this way, or the description seemed so drawn out, so detailed. In fact, I'm going to skip over a section. Let's look at chapter 7, verses 7 to 14, and then we'll skip over to verse 40 and pick up from there. So hear now God's word in the description of the temple and what's inside. And King Solomon sent and brought Hiram from Tyre. He was the son of the widow of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father was a man of Tyre, a worker in bronze. He was full of wisdom, understanding, and skill in the making of any work in bronze. He came to King Solomon and did all his work. He cast two pillars of bronze. Verse 41, or 40. Hiram also made the pots, the shovels, the basins. So Hiram finished all the work that he did for King Solomon on the house of the Lord, the two pillars with the two bowls of the capitals that were on the top of the pillars, and the two lattice works to cover the two bowls of the capitals that were on the tops of the pillars, and the 400 pomegranates for the two lattice works, two rows of pomegranates for each lattice work to cover the two bowls of the capitals that were on the pillars, the 10 stands and the 10 basins on the stands, and the one sea and the 12 oxen underneath the sea. Now the pots and the shovels and the basins and all the vessels in the house of the Lord, which Hiram made for King Solomon, were of burnished bronze. In the plain of Jordan, the king cast them in the clay ground between Succoth and Zarethan. And Solomon left all the vessels unweighed because they were so many of them. The weight of the bronze was not ascertained. So Solomon made all the vessels that were in the house of the Lord, the golden altar, the golden table for the bread of the presence, the lampstands of pure gold, five on the south side, five on the north, before the lamps and the tongs of gold, the cups, snuffers, basins, dishes for incense, and the fire pans of pure gold, and the sockets of gold, and for the doors of the innermost part of the house, the most holy place, and for the doors of the nave of the temple. Thus all the work that King Solomon did on the house of the Lord was finished. And Solomon brought in the things that David his father had dedicated, the silver and gold and the vessels, and stored them in the treasury of the house of the Lord. Well, here, the first thing that we do see is that God's house expresses God's creation. And we looked at this briefly last week, and as we come to it again, I think it's important to see it once again. What is it God had done? Well, first thing is that Solomon brings in Hiram of Tyre. Now, this was evidently a common name, because if you recall from 2 weeks ago, we looked at the wood cedar paneling that lined the inside and the ceiling and the cypress that was on the floor, and noticed that he got that from Hiram, the king of Tyre. And this is another guy, same name, Hiram, living in the same area. But we're told he is a son of a widow of Naphtali. He is a Jew by ancestry. But it was not just that. It was his skill he was looking for. And it's fascinating to see how he is described here. A man full of wisdom, understanding, and skill. We're not exactly sure of the process that was done in order to craft these things. As you begin to look at the dimensions, and we'll look at one in particular in just a few moments, these are huge bronze castings, probably created, and we have evidence of it being done in that time, in that place of the world. And in fact, even in the area that's mentioned there, they were done by what's called the lost wax process. If you've ever made some jewelry or done things like that, you might be aware of it, in which you craft something out of a wax, you put it in a sand clay mixture, in, you know, here, and they're so large, in the ground, and then you pour the molten bronze in, and it melts the wax. You lose the sculpture, but it takes that very form. In fact, in the plains of Succoth, they have found slags of copper and bronze in the soil from people using the soil there at some point, some 3,000 years ago or so. But what's fascinating here is how Hiram is described. He's full of wisdom. Isn't it amazing? You know, you think of understanding and skill, but they're using a term that's used of Solomon, of the king, and used of God. This is a man who is gifted of God for this specific task. In fact, it's even the same kind of descriptions that are used back in Exodus 31. In Exodus 31, when the tabernacle, the precursor, was being built, there was one gentleman, two, but one in particular that's mentioned, Bezaleel, in Exodus 31. And it says of him in Exodus 31 that the Lord said to Moses, "See, I have called by name Bezaleel, son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God, with ability and intelligence, with knowledge and all craftsmanship, to devise artistic designs, to work in gold and silver and bronze, in the cutting of stones for setting and the carving of wood, to work in every craft." And this gentleman, indeed, just like Hiram of Tyre, was used of God to create the vessels and the artifacts that were to be used in the context of worship. Now, what's amazing with this, we looked at it a little last 2 weeks ago, is that how much of this is really necessary? How necessary is it to have such craftsmanship? Because aren't these just functional pieces? If we could, you know, you could get them a lot cheaper at Walmart than having this artist do it. Okay. But here, there is a reason for doing it. For those of us who may live in a world of utilitarianism, those more pragmatic sorts, we see no need for beauty and art. But beware, that's not the God that we serve. The very God who creates the beauty of a baby's smile, the magnificence of the Grand Tetons as the sun sets, is the same God that gifts and gives skills and that sense of craftsmanship and calls people to recreate, to reflect his glory. As bearers of the image of God, and God's glory and majesty is reflected in how we live and what we do and all of our callings, and art is one of them. The understanding of aesthetics and art is indeed a calling from God. Now, the author hears in his description of the artistry and the craftsmanship, as you read that, especially verses 15 through 39, you got a sense of it just in the verses 40 and on that I read. It goes through this, to us, this minutia of detail. And we might kind of step back and go, why do I need to know all this? What is the purpose? You know, it's, again, as we've said before, it's not about so I can go and reconstruct a temple of my own. These aren't blueprints, but they are speaking to the very heart of the God who creates and his beauty. The repetition of images, though, at times will elicit a yawn for most of us, but there's something vital that we might miss. There is a simplistic beauty that the temple that is reiterated here in God's creative heart that we can often miss. Now, usually when we think of creativity, what do we think of? We think of originality, that something is creative if there's never anything like it elsewhere in the world. And that is an aspect of creativity. But as our creativity, it reflects the very character of God. Think about it. God at times in his creativity in this world creates things that are indeed very original. And sometimes with a certain maybe sense of humor. The aardvark and giraffe, I think, are among those things. You look at them and go, wow, what was he thinking? I look at some of you sometimes and think, God is good. But there's a simplistic beauty that we sometimes miss. That is not just about this originality, but for God, creativity is found in simplicity too. There is a writer from about a century ago. His name is G.K. Chesterton. Perhaps you've read some of his or heard him quoted before. Quote here from his work called Orthodoxy. And it's a great quote dealing with this very thing. Listen to what Chesterton wrote. He says this. "Now, to put the matter in popular phrase, it might be true that the sun rises regularly because he, God, never gets tired of rising. His routine might be due not to a lifelessness, but to a rush of life. The thing I mean can be seen, for instance, in children. When they find some game or joke that they especially enjoy, a child kicks his legs rhythmically through excess, not absence of life, because children have abounding vitality, because they are, in spirit, fierce and free. Therefore, they want things repeated and unchanged. They always say, "Do it again." And the grown-up person does it again until he is nearly dead. For grown-up people are not strong enough to exalt in monotony. Perhaps God is strong enough to exalt in monotony. It is possible that God says every morning, "Do it again," to the sun, and every evening, "Do it again," to the moon. It may not automatically necessitate that he make all daisies alike. It may be that God makes daisies separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has an eternal appetite of infancy. For we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. Now, for you artistic types who love to muse over poetry, you're just going, "Wow." The right brain sorts are going, "Well, that was rather silly. How can the Father be younger than we? He's infancy. That's just, you're not only irrelevant, but perhaps even irreverent." Now, to understand that when we engage God, we do so not just with the practical, not just with the theoretical, but the aesthetic as well. And to say that God, as he gives us this detail, is telling us something that he's doing even in our lives. That he loves the beauty, but even in the repetition of it. That God's people communicates what it means to be part of his family. And so as we look at these furnishings, we can see the picture of what God is doing in us. And so here, God's house not only expresses indeed his creation, but God's house also expresses his care for us. And what does that care look like? We're just going to look at four of the features here, somewhat rather briefly, not looking at everything and every excruciating detail, but just looking at this view of this house expressing his care. The first thing we would think about is the foundation. God's care is expressed in the strong foundation that he gives us. You know, when buying a house, what's the common term that one uses to describe the quality of the structure? You say it's got good bones, solid foundations, well built. You may not like the color, the carpet, a wall might need to be moved, but the foundations, bones are good. And so here we have that pictured as well, not so much with the foundation itself, but by one of the first things you see as you approach the door, the main doors, these two twin towers, these columns that are described there. You'll notice they're described in detail in verses 15 through 22, referred in verses 41 and 42 that's in your bulletin a bit more briefly. These columns are about 27 feet tall. On top is a capital. That's the top of, you think of a column. Usually when you think of a Greek Corinthian column, you think of those, the kind of the leaves that kind of come down on it. Well, here, this is a lily that goes up another 7 or so feet. So these are about 35 feet tall. So the column would be almost from floor to ceiling here in its total height. But not only that, the columns were about 18 feet around. So that would be almost if you took three men could wrap their arms around this column. It's a huge column. And what's interesting is nothing is described as these columns, they're not supporting anything. There's no functionality, if you will. There's no roof that's described. And it was a common feature in the ancient world to do this very thing because the columns themselves communicated something by their very presence. You look at a column, you think of strength and that pillar. You know, you talk of someone being the pillar of their community. Well, it's that kind of picture. But the picture is described even more. The columns are named. Ever think of naming the columns in front of your house? You know, this is my front door, Bill. This is my back door. You know, that's a strange thing. Well, the names communicate something as well. Yachim and Boaz. Yachim means he who is firm, established. Boaz, well, we know what Boaz means. It means strong, he who is strong. One look at Barry, we know. Strength, right? You know, some of us get all the cool names. Bird, yeah, great, Vogel. But Boaz, strong. Well, that's what the names of these two towers were. Well, why? Well, the term Yachim and Boaz are used often of speaking of the Davidic dynasty, of God's establishing the throne of David, not for David's sake or for Solomon's sake, but for the one who was to come to sit on the throne, the Messiah, Jesus Christ. It's also used of the permanency of God's promises made. The promise to send a Savior, but the reality that when God has said that you can come into this relationship, it has a solid foundation. It's firm. It's really very much what's pictured in we really do the same thing in our own kind of in our Constitution preamble. All I have to say is we the people. And it just elicits everything else that goes along with that. Our rights, our responsibilities as citizens. Well, so also with these two towers. They stand for something. It really is pictured again in Ephesians 2, a passage that, of course, for a church with the name Cornerstone has much meaning, when it describes this temple that's being built, and it's taking the picture of the temple there in Jerusalem and applying it to the church. And the foundation of that temple is what? What is the foundation? The foundation is the apostles and the prophets. But that doesn't end there with Christ Jesus as the cornerstone. An ancient building, that foundation, as it was laid, was very important. It was really the cornerstone that starts it off, and everything else comes out from it. And the prophets and the apostles, we would say the Old Testament, the New Testament, having at its nexus and determining how the angles are to run, is that cornerstone, Jesus Christ. It is the same picture as we would see in 1 Timothy chapter 3, when Paul writes to Timothy, "I hope to come to you soon, but I am writing these things to you so that, if I delay, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, a pillar and buttress of truth." No, we say here that this picture of the temple is to say there is something firm and established. This is not something that's wishy-washy, that is here today and gone tomorrow. That even when that temple was destroyed, the truth of what God was saying would remain. And we hear it in the gospel, that you are invited to come in, to be part of this household, part of this new family, not on the basis of who you are, but God's promise which will stand. You and I are not firm. We are not established, and we are not strong. And God says, that's okay. I'm strong enough for you. Trust me. And so we see here God providing us with a firm foundation, but that's not all. God also provides us with cleansing. You know, when it comes to our homes, I'm glad I live when I do and where I do. Indoor plumbing is not a luxury. I think my grandparents, certainly my great-grandparents, grew up without it. I can't imagine life that some of you have perhaps lived in that situation, but I'm sorry. As I stumble out of bed in the morning, there is a small room I wish to go before I greet the rest of the day. We want to be clean. We want to be presentable. And so as one approaches the temple, one of the first things they see, as they see these two towers rising above, they would come and see this large basin of water. It's called the sea. That's a little intimidating, isn't it? It's described in verse 44, just with that phrase of one of the bronze things he made, the sea. It's described in more detail in verses 23 to 26. In short, this thing held 10,000 gallons of water. It was 7 feet high, 15 feet across. It was, 45 feet in circumference. So, it could probably be about the size of this whole area. And the purpose of it was for cleansing, for washing. It also, with the word sea, brings up certain connotations. In the ancient world, and we see it in the Old Testament and in Judaism, it's an understanding of the sea would often represent chaos. And so the separation of the dry land from the waters in creation, that sense of the terrors of the sea, in a world in which conquering the ocean was not an easy task. And so that picture of bringing order out of chaos is even in constructing, going, there, God has control even over that which to us may seem chaotic. But there's also the picture of cleansing. As the priests would come each day to serve in the temple, they would have to cleanse themselves. Not just the simple necessity of the dust and the dirt of the ancient world, but also that picture to remind them spiritually that they can't approach God without first being cleansed. But there is another very functional reason. Not only was there this large sea out front, the bronze sea, if you will, in which they cleansed, there is also smaller units, 10 of them that are described in chapter 7 here, inside the temple, each holding about 200 gallons, lining the walls, and again, intricately designed. Why? We're not exactly told exactly how they function, but again, if you can imagine living in that part of the world, no running water, per se, the necessity to clean, but remember what's going on in here. There's a lot of sacrifices going on. A few of you have, you know, if you've hunted, you've gutted your deer, you've done all that work. I mean, you know, Jay comes home. Jay, do you wash up before you come home from butchering? Good. I'm sure, you know, Vicky appreciates that. But you can imagine, he comes home covered in, yes, blood, you know, holding a knife. His kid's customer wasn't nice to me today. Are you going to be nice to me? You know, no. You want to get cleaned up first, don't you? And that's what it's all about. And here, these priests, they're handling these animals, the guts, the entrails. I won't go any further. It's gross. They need to be cleaned. And that is exactly what the picture here is for us as well. It's more than a cleansing bath. This points us to God's provision for holiness. God's goodness and his grace that says, you come to me unclean and I will cleanse you. Now, you and I, you know, we clean ourselves. We're competent and capable. But when it comes to our necessity to be cleansed before God, we are much more the infant in needing of the bath given to us. You don't tell the 18-month-old, get upstairs, get a bath, get to bed. Now, you might want to do that, parents. Please don't do it. It's irresponsible. But with God, he takes us as those small children. He says, I will cleanse you, not you yourself. A while back, I was talking to someone who was in the midst of a kind of a crisis point in their life, and they just made the statement, well, I'm just going to have to put on my church face and act as though everything's fine. And I sat there with my mouth just dropped. I said, what does that mean? Well, you know, my church face. I need to look like I got my act together. And I went, please don't do that. Oh, please. Of any place, this is where you can come, relatively speaking, filthy, right? Dirty, messed up, completely at a loss. There's no church face before God. There's the filth of our sin. And then we come and we hear from God, and I have cleansed you. See that picture, especially in Hebrews, of what Christ has done for us, cleansing our consciences. Well, God not only provides a strong foundation, provides a cleansing, he also provides us with acceptance. You know, in your homes, how do you know you're being listened to? Your mouth's moving, right? Doesn't mean you're being listened to. If you've got perhaps kids or a spouse who somehow can hear the words but doesn't hear a thing you're saying, because sometimes we're competing with various devices clamoring for attention. It's not just the TV or the earbuds blocking out distracting voice. It's the laptop, iPad, cell texting all at once. The other day, Jan and I were walking through a kid's toy store, and she held it up, and I knew right away what it was. You know, one of those favorite kid books, Good Night Moon. But it wasn't Good Night Moon. It was called Good Night iPad. You know, it's great. I was going to bring it in. I was thinking about it already. I was going to read you, you know, Good Night iPad. You know, we all would like that, but it doesn't always happen. But let me ask you a question. Where does all that technology take place in your homes? I know in the Vogel household, there have been times in which, you know, all four or five of us are sitting in the family room. Oh, the family room. Each with some electronic device communicating with someone not in the room. I won't go any further. And occasionally, just to be annoying, we Skype the person on the couch or text the person over by the computer. You know, when you have to call your kids downstairs for dinner by texting them, Because yelling up the stairs not only hurts the voice, accomplishes nothing. But no, there is something here in the temple that helps communicate even more clearly acceptance. Now, family room is a place of acceptance, or the living room, you might say, whatever great room you have might picture that. You can think in the context of the temple and the furnishings that are there, it's when you come into the front room of the temple, into the holy place, not the Holy of Holies, in that first large front room, there is something called the altar of incense. This altar of incense, indeed, is described in verse 48. This altar of incense was fueled by coals taken from the altar outside where the sacrifices were made. The coals, the fire was lit to consume the burnt offering, demonstrating the sin was being atoned for, pointing us to what Christ would do. Those coals upon which the blood of that sacrifice had dropped would be taken out while still red hot, taken inside of the altar of incense, placed in there, and then the incense would be placed on top and the smoke would fill the room. Again, not just for a pragmatic reason of you can imagine the stench in there from one year to the next, but because it illustrated something very important, the prayers of God's people being raised up. This is very much what was understood of the temple in Revelation 5, this picture again of the temple on earth really being a picture of what heaven is all about. And in Revelation 5, John says, 5:8, John says this, "And when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and a golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints." Now, the picture, the understanding that incense is prayers. Now, why am I saying this is acceptance? It's the fact that the incense, as the smoke was rising up, it was a symbol, a reminder, a pointer to that our prayers are heard by God and He accepts us. See, what He does for us is something that we strive in our homes, but even in the best of circumstances, doesn't happen. Because with God, there are no distractions, nothing clamoring for His attention. With God, we are not just being heard, but we are accepted. And this might be a far cry from what your life has been, perhaps even up till this point, but you know there's something missing, and this is what the gospel is telling us. There is acceptance, and it's not something we create by trying to have the perfect marriage, by being the best parent or the best child. We know that ultimately we're created for a relationship with God, and that's what it all points to. There is in our house, in our living room by the front door, a red wingback chair. There's one very similar to it on the other side of the piano, but if you've been in our house and come over maybe for a Bible study or just to sit and talk, you might notice that's the chair I sit in. I asked Michael before he left this morning to head back to college, "Michael, what do you think of that red chair?" He said, "That's your chair." So what does that chair mean to you? I said, "Is it frightening at all?" He said, "No. But if you were sitting in that chair and I was on the sofa, I better listen." But at the same, as we talked a little bit more before we left, but still understanding there is a sense of comfort with that. That if I was sitting in that chair, I'm not being distracted by TV, by any device. I'm there to talk, to listen, to respond. And so that picture of acceptance is exactly what we see at the altar of incense, that God hears us and cares for us. It's not only the strong foundation, a cleansing acceptance, but it's also His presence, God's presence, the final piece of furniture to look at here. His presence in the context of a table and a meal. Growing up, my parents would sometimes so often try to seek to instill good table manners, and my brother and I, Janet would say, they failed terribly. They really didn't stick. Well, at times, one thing my father would say, and it became a joke in the house, my father would say to Mark and I, my brother, he would say, "You know, if you keep acting like this, I will not take you to the Hamilton Club." The Hamilton Club was his dining club. And, well, it certainly, as an adult, it's a fun place to go to have a nice meal. But to an 8-year-old boy, the Hamilton Club meant you had to wear a coat and tie, you have impeccable manners, and could only speak when spoken to. That was not a threat. That was an encouragement to Miss Moore misbehavior, actually. But in that same way, in short, while I'm all for dining etiquette, and at times we've joked, we need to move, when the kids were younger, move the kids from the kitchen into the dining room, because if they were seated over carpet with fine china, they might behave better. We never did that. We are not that foolish. But there is something about the kitchen that really is wonderfully warm and inviting. It might be some of the hijinks of adolescence at the table. It may just be hijinks of a 50-year-old man at the table as well. But there is that family connection that takes place, that friendship and that fellowship over food and a meal. And the context and the picture there in the temple, along with that altar of incense in the room, there is also the table of the bread of the presence. An old King James called it the table of showbread. There was a table on which 12 loaves of bread were placed each week by the priests as a reminder of God's provision, of his presence with his people, in which picturing how God provided for them with manna in the wilderness, but how God provides by ordinary means each and every day as well. And so as the priests would go in, that reminder in that in God's house, he feeds and cares for his people. God does not belittle us at the table, saying, you know, if you don't behave in my presence, I will not bless your life. I will withhold something good from you. It's not saying that at all. He's saying, come on in, just eat. I'm here, and I'm going to love you and show you my grace and my nourishment. Each and every day, he does that for us. He does not withhold his presence based on our behavior. Rather, it's his presence that shapes and fills our lives with the food that we need. There is an order of understanding how our relationship as God's people, as his family, as his children, come about. In so many churches, it looks like this order, and I've shared with some of you in the past. Sometimes in many churches, and I would say in most religions, the order goes like this. First, you got to behave, then you better believe, then you can belong. So the first order to go through is behavior. At least clean up your life sufficiently, and then agree to what we agree to, then you can be one of us. Maybe you've been in a church like that. Really, I think biblically, the gospel reverses that order. It says, I'll tell you what, come on in, you belong. And as you're belonging, you're going to hear things and learn things. And as now you are belonging, you're going to start believing certain things. And in time, behavior will come. If you misbehave, guess what? Let's talk about what you're believing. Having troubles with what you're believing? No. We've brought you into the family. Stay with us. Let's grow together as a family. You know, we do that with our kids, don't we? We bring them home from the hospital and don't demand the newborn to know certain facts about their address and their telephone number and what chores they, and we don't expect certain behavior out of them other than crying and other bodily functions. We don't kick them out because they're not behaving. No, indeed, that is a very important part of the process of what we see here in this picture of the temple and the furnishings on the inside. How God indeed calls us and equips us to do that very thing in our lives. That we belong. He calls us to believe. And out of that comes the behavior that he desires out of us. And it's for that reason, each and every week, there is that call for you to take a hold of the gospel and to see its function in your life today, tomorrow. Let's pray. Gracious God, cause us.